Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of Torkum Talk. Today I am so pumped about our guest, Ken Streeter. We've had so many wide-ranging conversations about philosophy and life and the world. He is just a brilliant man who is author of The Gift of Courage and Be the Good. And he is speaking at the Legends and Luminaries talk with Les Brown himself and an all-star lineup that will be at the Tower Theater on April 24th. Make sure you get your tickets for that. And we basically went over so many things, like from when he thought he was going to die in Hawaii when the bomb was being dropped, or everyone thought it was because all the notifications said this is not a drill, and what he learned from that, to how do you become a good person day after day, which seems like, oh, it's very easy. But I know a lot of people really struggle with it. And so we were basically able to tackle all these different things and how to make big impacts into another person's life. And well, really, I hope you guys enjoy this podcast between me and Ken Streeter. Thanks. So, Ken, you're speaking at the Tower Theater with a list of other people, including Les Brown, and it's a series called Legends and Luminaries, April 24th. So, curious, first, what is it for our listeners, and why should one from Oregon go to this?
Great questions. Legends and Luminaries is a series of live events that feature legends and or luminaries, people in different genres, whether they're an entrepreneur or a personal development leader, author. And the idea is to impart pearls of wisdom, to share pearls of wisdom to the audience members in Bend regarding following your dreams, mm-hmm. running the business that you've always wanted to, being a good parent, being engaged in the community. There's all kinds of different levels that will reach people, and they'll come via the different speakers that are presenting at each show to begin with, but then also over the course of the year at the series.
Why do you feel so strongly about being involved in this?
I've been a community advocate on one level or another for years, mm-hmm. and I just feel like there's an opportunity for, in Ben's case in particular, for Ben to benefit from information and enthusiasm and camaraderie, and this type of event provides that, where people are in the audience wanting to learn about how to be better community members, better people, better business people. And given the caliber of the speakers and the diverse backgrounds, everybody's going to be touched and everyone should be inspired.
So Ken, I know from talking to you before, we had a great 2-hour conversation in the office last week, just went deep into different like philosophies and trying to solve all the world's problems is fascinating. So I know deep down that you're not in this for ticket sales or money or anything like that. What are you trying, like what's, if one person can walk out of there learning one thing that influences them, would that, A, are you going to be happy if it's just one? And B, what would be the main thing you'd want that one person to change?
Yeah, I think if each person learned one thing and created a shift in their own life, then we all benefit from that. And I'm reading a book right now called The Happiness Trap. And the essence of The Happiness Trap is to act on your values. And a lot of times we get lost in what our values are, and we certainly get distracted from acting on our values. And being able to sit in front of people who have good information and who are motivating you to be a better person, it gives you 15 minutes to 2 or 3 hours to reflect on what matters to you, or to really research again and come to know your values. And then given the platform of this event or these events, you're inspired to go act on those values. And if you're not acting on your values, there's a really good chance that your life is not as fulfilling as it could be, and that you're not doing as much as you possibly could to help the person next door, the person up the street.
Right, and so do you understand where people come from though when they're thinking, yeah, that all sounds good, but I need to make sure I'm paying my mortgage?
As one of those people, I completely understand that. And so the change doesn't have to be a fire hose change or a groundswell or tsunami change. Literally, you can do one thing new tomorrow, mm-hmm. to make a difference in your life and somebody else's life. And that doesn't get in the way of you making a living. That doesn't take any more time than it does to watch 5 minutes of TV or look at your Facebook page or your social media accounts all day. Mm-hmm. You can take a bite of your day and make a huge change in somebody's life just by doing one simple thing.
In your new book coming out that I was reading through, and so far I'm loving it, Be the Good. When's that come out, by the way?
Should be out by April 24th.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good timing. Yep. So you had 20 different lessons mm-hmm. in it when it came to how to be good. And it seems so simple. People are like, oh yeah, you know, just be good and everything like that. But then why are so many people not doing it? There's a lot of people who are, don't get me wrong, but we run across people that you can see that their motives are self-centered, mm-hmm. A bit of arrogance. In my opinion, they just don't know what they do. So the best we can do is teach them. I fall into that myself, where I occasionally, I used to do it a lot more, but I occasionally will be like going after self-centered, arrogant things. And I just pull myself back, like, why are you doing this? You're really just looking to push yourself. So the book is actually, there's a lot of them that are simple, but profound. So what two are your favorite? I mean, there's a bunch that I was connecting with, but what two stick out to you much out of the 20?
So they're all my favorites, and two that come to mind today, and two that I think apply to this conversation because we're talking about this event. One is share something of yourself, and it can be time, energy, money, talent. It's share something of yourself. And another one is to choose trust over fear. And we've become so overwhelmed by different industries trying to have us choose fear. Mm-hmm. We're marketed to choose fear.
Like what industries?
Insurance, pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. Politicians, politics. We're being marketed to fear because there's big money in fear.
I watched your TED Talk. You were talking about with the pharmaceutical companies. They are getting us anxious about our anxiety medication.
Yeah, exactly. That's an incredible whirlpool.
Right. I never thought of it like that. I'm like, that they are. Yeah. These freaking marketing campaigns are like, you're having problems. You're thinking the whole world's going to come and eat this pill. Are you eating enough of our pills? Yeah. I don't know. I don't think so. Go talk to your doctor about getting more.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so if you have a chance in your day-to-day living to choose trust over fear, then you offset that influence. And even if it's a 1% shift, and you know, a perfect example of that is if you're walking down the street mm-hmm. and you're coming upon somebody who your judgment tells you that it may not be the smartest thing to make eye contact with them and nod and smile.
That's what your judgment says.
Yeah.
You think that's an American judgment? I'm sorry to, I want your thought to keep on going, but I'm curious.
It is to some degree an American judgment.
Or is it a human?
It can be both. Yeah. It can be both. I mean, we obviously here in this country are inundated with the idea of it's important to be judgmental and fearful. But I compare it actually walking down a street in America to walking down a street in Africa. I was in Zimbabwe. And the people in Zimbabwe, when you walk down a street, they nod at you. They're actually guys holding guys' hands. They're connected. They're trusting each other. And in Bend and Redmond, it's not too bad because generally speaking, people will make eye contact with you. Not always, but generally speaking. But in big cities in particular, it's really hard because there's this fear, this underlying fear of connecting.
I have a theory on that, actually. And I think it transcends not only, I'm not saying it's right, but this is what I've always thought, that the greater the population density, the meaner the person becomes because they don't have time to be holding open a door and looking and smiling at each person as you're going through Times Square. I'm not saying that you shouldn't, but that's just kind of been my theory. And I kind of been noticing as Ben's been growing a bit more and more that less people are holding open doors and less people are waiting for you to cross the street.
Yeah. And
it's not like what it was 8 years ago.
Your theory is spot on. And part of it is kind of the always under the microscope syndrome too. In a big city, you are constantly barraged with connections mm-hmm. and you constantly regard possibly that somebody is judging you. And so it becomes easy to disconnect, even in something as simple as not making eye contact. And you're right that Bend is starting to feel a little bit of that, part of it might be folks that are coming from outside of the area. That
coming from bigger cities.
Right, and yeah. they just haven't engaged on how we're doing things here. And I can tell you, we did a workshop a year ago in Bend where there were 20 different topics, and people would go from one table to another, kind of round robin of business understanding. And the table that was voted the most successful at that conference was the table that dealt with collaboration. And it was really...
What event was this?
What
was the event? Yeah,
it was
Innovation Day. Maybe?
Innovation Day.
That's yeah, right. Okay, yeah. I was there. I was like, it sounds very familiar. It was super fun.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't stick around for the winter, so it was collaboration.
Collaboration was the, and this was after the event survey.
Okay.
But the table on collaboration was the most highly regarded, and I think that's because Bend, by its nature, has this collaborative fabric. And
I would agree with that.
We don't want to watch that go away, and that's another reason that this event matters. Is because it's bringing people together. Community leaders and business owners who value the collaborative nature of Bend, and we'll speak to that.
Fascinating point. So I've been here for I've been coming to Bend all my life from Chicago, and then went to Oregon State, and then I've been living here for 8 years. But I want to hit on what you were just saying. So the collaboration thing and the potential of it losing. One thing that I really love about this, after doing business in Chicago, is that we aren't out there sniping employees from each other, but that's starting to rear. It's starting to pick up a little bit. When my mentor, Preston Calicott, Five Talent, has never been about like sniping anything like that. And all of a sudden it's starting to happen to him a bit more. And with me, I've never even tried, but all of a sudden my team's getting kind of pinged here and there. Do you think this conference could help with that? Because overall, when it comes to be the good, when it comes to doing good, when it comes to what this conference, what I think it's about, like, how do you be good, morally correct? I cannot justify being like, I'm going to take this employee from this person, and I know deep down it's the right move.
Right.
Because that's me justifying it.
Right.
And as soon as I start justifying it, like, well, you know, they probably aren't happy. And it's like, no, it's just not right.
Right.
So I don't engage in it. Now, people might come to me. And in which case, one company that we're a partner with, G5, they're basically like a giant Mazama, but in a different industry now. So we don't compete for the same industry, but we do look after, we do pretty much want to hire around the same people. And we work together on clients. And so I never go to snipe any G5 employees, and I'm pretty sure they don't with us, but I will have... people occasionally hit me up on LinkedIn that want to come over, in which case I'll like entertain the idea. And then if we get close to it, then I'll ask my contacts over there. I'm like, here's the deal. This person reached out to me. They're not happy over there. I don't want you to think I sniped them. And they're typically cool with it. But as I'm even saying this out loud, I just see myself justifying it as well. Right.
Right.
So at what point, this is like a, like, where am I going too far into the gray here through that story, or am I?
So I think those are great questions, and I have a couple of thoughts around that. I cut my teeth in business owning a rafting and adventure travel company, and the industry was collaborative to its core. It was initially a bunch of guys who just loved rafting who wanted to go run a company. And so there was this labor of love that was a common thread among all of the outfitters. And the belief was that you could grow your business without taking a bigger slice of the pie. You just needed to grow the pie. And so all the outfitters worked towards that end. So that's one thing. And if you consider Bend or Central Oregon to be kind of an outfitting industry, but instead of an industry, it's a geography,
right,
then maintaining that philosophy where let's grow the pie and let's not start trying to grow our piece by slicing something out of something finite.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it's important to just have this conversation. And this event is going to have parts of that, to have this conversation. You and I talking about it is important. Put the cards on the table. You know, we're all in this together. We've got this local community that is thriving, and we want it to continue to thrive. And it's going to suffer if we start to snipe, to use your words, if we start to take employees from other people, and everybody would suffer. The tenor of the collegiality gets dented then. And then lastly, it's super, super important, and we talked about this a little bit last week, Immanuel Kant, in The Categorical Imperative, this is a tome, a lesson that he wrote in the 1800s. One of the keystone comments and concepts in that was that right doesn't need to be justified. Right does not need to be defined. Mm-hmm. And so if you're finding yourself justifying what you're doing, then there's a really good chance that deep down inside, you know it's not right. So when you justify a behavior, you're basically trying to define right. And we all know what right is. Mm-hmm. And so if you maintain the connection to what is right in your gut, then it becomes more challenging to do the things that you're describing.
So one of my things I say a lot, it's typically my LinkedIn status, so to speak, is instead of CEO and founder and all that stuff, it's now something different, but it'll go back to trying to do the right thing while being the best leader I can be. So this is where I'm honestly asking, like I've changed my mindset from I want to make $100 million marketing company to I want to prove that it is possible to build a successful company while doing good, being nice, and doing what is right to others. But the example I was giving you, that kind of stuff does come up. Like if the person wants, in that G5 example, if the person wants to leave and actively see you, and then you're just like, okay, well, I guess we could really use that help and they're not happy there, but then that's not right to G5. But like that to me, that's like that gray area. Yeah. That I'm sincerely asking about. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, so to me, the solution is to look at the steps that you would need to take between that person working at another place and that person coming to work at your place. Mm-hmm. And so there's obviously the confidentiality component. You don't want that person to suffer as the result of them reaching out to you and then having it relayed to, in this case, G5.
Right.
But you also want what's best for you, mm-hmm. and what's best for them and what's best for G5. And so if you look at it holistically and analyze the steps from first contact to possible hire, if every one of those steps feels right to you, which is I'm going to talk to this person because I think I have an opportunity to help them. And if they're not satisfied at G5, then it may be an opportunity for G5 to find somebody that would be satisfied. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to decide whether or not this person is worth being in our employ. And at what point then is it your obligation, if you're talking about doing right, to actually reach out to G5 with that person's approval, mm-hmm. to say, this is what's happening, and I want to make sure that we're all on the same page, the cards are up. Because at that point, if you've looked at every step and you haven't tried to justify it because it does have rightness to it, then there's no shuck and jive, you know?
Well, I'm glad you explained it like that, because that's basically what I've done. Awesome. So I was like, okay, good. But I guess as I was explaining it to you the first time, I was just hearing myself justifying what I was doing. And I before you said that quote, who was that from?
Immanuel Connor.
I've always kind of thought that to myself too, because most of the time it's much more cut and dry, right? You're just like, I had a client once that came to us and they were in a year agreement and they were getting a startup going, and the money behind the startup, the husband, who was making a very good living in a certain industry, got let go. And they came in here, the husband looked like he hadn't slept in a week because he hadn't. They were both teary-eyed and basically pleading with me to let me out of their agreement so that they can try to save their house and things of that nature. And now you could go, well, I'm sorry, but you signed that and that's just kind of the way it is, like, which a lot of fucking companies do. Yeah. But to me, it was just a no-brainer. Like, no, absolutely, you guys are fine. And they're like, really? Like that? I was just like, yeah. I mean, if everything works out, you want to come back, fine, but don't. Like, you need to get through this. And then I gave him some books on, I gave him the book from Ryan Holiday, which is, why is this space on me right now? But he's basically a modern day Stoic. Oh, The Obstacle is Away. That's a book I've given out so many times that I was just having a brain fart on. But it was just because like they're going through all this stuff right now. And I was like, not only am I gonna let you guys out, but you guys need to like read this book and understand that good is going to come from this. Like, it's only bad if you think it is. And that's really easy advice to say, and it's when you're going through something like that. But if you really do practice it, if you really do consume a certain philosophy, then you really start believing it. Then all of a sudden, it's only bad if you really do think it is.
Yeah.
And it's good if you think it is, because it's all just a construct. Like, so anyway, that's like the more cut and dry one. So I was kind of curious for other people, and they're doing it. It's like, at what point is it? And so if you think to yourself, okay, in this contract, these people went out, but hey, they did sign it. That is their signature.
Yeah.
You do owe me another 9 months.
Yeah.
That's your word. Like you can make up a story
right. That
you're right. Right.
Right.
And you can go and talk to your buddies at the bar and be like, yeah, yeah, right. You know, they tried to get out and, you know, sorry, but, you know, you signed it. We put all this work in,
right.
And we balance out that price over the course of the year, which is something that we do. So I was hitting the red from it, but whatever, they weren't acting.
Yeah.
You knew right away, like, this is, oh my God. But people do that. People go the other way.
To me, it's like a fulcrum is, are you justifying your actions? And if you're justifying them egregiously, you're way out of line with doing what's right.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge that we see with industry and corporate mentalities, even politicians, is the justification of right gets in the way of communities and country actually flourishing because there's this baseline of trust.
And, you know, it's interesting on that too, is something I was grappling with yesterday, which a lot of entrepreneurs will have to, if not are currently dealing with this in America, and a lot of people that are come and watch you talk should be thinking about this, and that is this 900-pound elephant in the country of maternity leave, right? Like, so Finland is like 3 years. Our neighbors in the north is a year, paid, by the way. England's 48 months, I believe. And basically the developed world is, we're going to take care of you. And I was researching, like, well, okay, why is that? And it's like, well, it's the right thing to do, right? You just feel like, okay, this woman's giving birth. She's helping push the species along. It's probably good for everyone
that
she does that well.
Yeah.
And then America, the law is 12 weeks
right. Unpaid.
12 weeks unpaid, that's all. So basically that means that as a business, you have to guarantee that she will have her job after 3 months
right. From
having a child. Right. And then 62% of businesses do not even offer paid, period. So that's a fascinating justification for me.
It's no coincidence that the happiest first world countries on earth are the ones that are most aligned with human values. No coincidence that Finland and Norway, Sweden, Iceland, they have systems that provide for health certainty and the well-being of individuals and families.
Mm-hmm.
They're also the most literate countries in the first world.
That's fascinating.
They're also the least media exposed countries in the first world.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because they have a cultural underpinning that says, let's honor each other first, and then let's honor business second. And so the paradox or the contrast between what they're doing on human services fronts, on wellness fronts, and what we're doing, it's vastly different. And one is, I'll be the first to admit that an economic system like theirs has challenges for businesses, period. But on one hand, it's driven by a cultural fabric, an economic theory that says a healthy and happy populace is far better than a extra overly taxed productive one.
Fascinating. So here I am, trying to figure out with our first team member who is pregnant, what the hell can we afford and what can we do? And I know 62% do unpaid, which actually I didn't know that. I knew that the majority did. When I saw that, I was just like, oh my God, we're so screwed. And we're a company that's been built from the ground up, bootstrap, no investors, so I don't have a pot of gold. And I was just like, but I'm not going to be like, well, because other companies are doing this, that means I can. Mm-hmm. Which I could have justified that and There was some entrepreneurs that are American that I was talking with that were justifying that position as well. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. And so we did the math and decided like, okay, we can do 16 weeks or more. I really like, if they need more, they can, of unpaid and 8 weeks paid. Mm-hmm. I told the team member that yesterday and she was almost in tears. Okay. But I feel like what I said to her right away was like, okay, I feel still awful about this. So I hope you're going to be upset at me that when the next woman becomes pregnant here, needs to have a kid, that she's going to get a way better package than you did. Mm-hmm. Because that, like, as we grow, I want to be able to like take care of that. So that's what I'm able to do now. And I'm also competing with a bunch of people that aren't doing it at all.
Yeah. So I'm gonna tell you a story about my arrival here today. When I walked in your front door, I couldn't see anybody here. Mm-hmm. And I saw a couple of dogs, and then I saw a couple people around the corner. But what I heard, what I felt when I first walked in, mm-hmm. was the laughter coming from people working here that I could not see. They were clearly doing something together that was enjoyable because it was gut, from the gut laughter. And then I kind of edged around the corner and there I saw your team in a circle and I'm not sure what was happening.
It's our morning meeting, yeah.
It didn't matter to me what was happening. Mm-hmm. What mattered to me was what they were feeling, what I was feeling, which was good about being here. And that was reflected in the laughter. And so your policy, my guess, is at least in part born from that environment, born from that character, born from that attitude. And in the end, even if your buddies up the street are not doing it, you go to bed at night without wondering whether or not you're justifying right.
You literally have me tearing up a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's what you just talked, that's what I care about more than anything. It's like making like the culture as good as we can, taking care of like that. That's what ended up taking over my mind instead of like making $100 million company and do whatever it takes to get there. I'm glad you felt that. That's what I
felt it, and I'm. It's an honor to see the tears in your eyes because people here. I don't know it from the depths of business sense, but I know it from what I felt this morning. People here were having fun this morning.
Good. All right. So another question. So also, Ken, it's been fun. We just met like last week and you end up knowing my sister really well, who's leads just an excellent theater department, yeah. three-time nationals. And I was just kind of like saying like, oh yeah, Ken's going to be in an office, like different colleagues. And I'm like, oh, he's a, like, everybody's saying all these fantastic things. And that wasn't surprised at all, because in our 2-hour conversation, what was coming out to me was like, philosophically, this man is looking for what is best for other people and not himself. And I know you read, because yeah. You referred a few books to me. And so I'm curious, what's the number one book you gift people?
It depends on where I've been in life. There's three that come to mind. One is The Council of Dads by Bruce Feiler. I think I'm saying it right, either Feiler or Feiler. And that's a story about a guy who's dying, and he rounds up his friends and business associates and forms a council of dads, which each individual person in that group had a strength that he knew would be able to provide for his children after he passed away. Second one is
a council of dads.
Council of dads.
Okay. Where did that happen?
I think it's Chicago. It's one of the bigger cities. He lives in one of the bigger cities. And it was a guy who knew he was going to pass away, and he wanted to give his kids opportunities to feel loved and to learn and to explore. And so he created a group of friends to be the council of replacement dads for him.
Have you heard of a book called Sex at Dawn?
No.
So it's a fascinating book about basically monotony, and it goes through all these examples of around the world or where people are not monogamous and different benefits, and it's basically like, hey, there's different reasons why and why not. But one thing that was fascinating in it is that there's this village in China, and they've been doing the same sort of family since they've been around, so thousands of years. And what it is there is no father for a kid. It's actually all the men and the brothers that take care of the kid, and people aren't even sure who the father is.
Wow.
But it doesn't matter, because everybody's taking care of everyone, and basically women have these flower rooms, and the men that they agree to, they'll come in at night and they'll, you know, mate, and then they'll go on with their lives, and then the whole village takes care of the kid, and they just have an incredibly no depression, and everybody looks at them like, that's different, blah, 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 you know, that's not like man and woman for the rest of their life and blah, blah, blah. And that's the thing that's pounded into our heads. And that was just the thing that's coming to me, is just like all the success stories that were from that study, and there's many others around that are just like, look at how happy these people are and the lowest rate of suicide and all this sort of stuff. And it was all due to, well, who knows what it was truly due to, but like having a council of dads, it's not like the whole, it takes a village to raise a family sort of thing. So that was fascinating. That's why I think I would definitely like to check out that book. So he had a council of dads in Chicago. And so he knew he was going to pass away. Do you know how many dads he brought into?
I think there were five or six. Yeah, I can't remember for sure, but I think there are five or six. Speaking of five or six, I have, I think, five or six copies of that book still on my bookshelf so that I can give it away.
So what happens when, one of the things in your book you're talking about is to care for another people, mm-hmm. care for other people and be good, right? So just open up your heart to, as you put it, is write down five people or five or six people that you can care for more, and just pick one or two.
Right.
And just care more. And how do you do that? And what your quote was, put your heart on your sleeve.
Yeah. And so I call that expanding your compassion circle. Mm-hmm. And this book was an example of that, where each one of us in our day-to-day life, we have a handful of people that we're most connected to. It's generally a spouse and children, and maybe a really good friend, and maybe a close relative.
Right.
So, if it's 6-10 people, that's your compassion circle. Mm-hmm. And if you have an opportunity to just expand that, then by one or two people, then imagine the intersections of more people tended to growing throughout the world. Before you know it, everybody is cared for because you've expanded your compassion circle. And the best story or example I have of that, and it's in the book, is there's an organization called the Flying Seagulls out of the UK, and it's a group of 20 and 30 year olds, maybe some older folks in it, but they go as a troop, T-R-O-U-P-E, to refugee camps. And they're actors and magicians and musicians and clowns. And they take this traveling troop from one refugee camp to another and give the people in those camps an opportunity to just experience joy and laughter for a day or two. Mm-hmm. And so what they've done is they've expanded the compassion circle in the world by doing this. Now, this gets back to the question of we're trying to make a living, and how could you possibly find time to do anything magnanimous like that? Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that
good word for that.
Yeah. Part of the reason that we choose to not do that mm-hmm. is because it's overwhelming when we think about, oh my gosh, how I can't change the world. It's too big to change the world. There's no way that I would ever be able to undertake something like that, create an organization like that. So I may as well not even try. Mm. The flip side to that is you list five people in your life that you know would benefit from you being more compassionate to them. Mm-hmm. You pick two, and tomorrow you go do something for them that helps them recognize that you feel for them and that they have somebody who wants to help them.
What if somebody's sitting around being like, okay, Ken, I jot it down and I think I could help my friend a bit more at who's a manager at a restaurant. I know him well, but and this all sounds good, but do I just walk up tomorrow and be like, hey, I'm gonna take care of you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's what you say. I know that you've been working 7 days a week, 5 days a week, 15 hours a day, and my guess is you haven't had a lot of time to just go do something because you're tending to your kids. Mm-hmm. I'm going to come over and babysit for you on Saturday. You and your wife go have fun. You and your girlfriend go have fun. You and your boyfriend go get away for the night. Mm-hmm. Something as simple as that. It's a use of a few hours of your time, and it would make a world of difference to them. It's that simple. So if you want to, in addition to making that list of five people, as you come up with that list, you list each person and you say, to help this person, I could take dinner to them tonight, drive their kids to their sporting events, whatever. And you list the things that you could do. And it only needs to be a list of three or four things per person. And then you say, the person that I can help the most easily is this person, because I can do the three things that I've listed next to them in the next week. And it's not going to, it's no skin off my knees. It's no extra effort in my life to really make it happen.
Who should be the credit? Like, if somebody were listening to me, like, okay, but who, I'll help. You could see how some people could be like, I'll help, you know, I'm going to help Dan Hoven or Gary Fish. Mm-hmm. That's the CEO of G5 and Deschutes, respectively. Mm-hmm. I think they're just lying to themselves, saying it's a way for them to get closer to that person.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that there might be some manipulation involved?
Yeah, exactly.
Then you go back, and I know we're kind of harping on this, but then you go back to, does right need defining? And if you know in your gut and in your heart that there's an ulterior motive there, then you're trying to justify doing right. And it's pointless. And part of the reason that it's pointless is because the recipient knows. The gig is up because the recipient knows whether or not you're being genuine or not.
Fascinating on that. You know, Gary Vaynerchuk?
Yeah.
So he gets offered all the time for be taken out to lunch and get ride to the airport. And he's just like, no, I'm not going to let you drive me to the airport to pitch me for a half hour on what your plan is, right, or like to hire me or whatever the case is, because there's just an underlying thing. So that's why I brought that up. A couple of these, like, you know, people could just be like, oh, I'll go and help these people so I get help more.
Right.
So, and this seems ridiculous, but I still want to ask it because I think a lot of people can gain from it. How do you unselfishly help somebody? Like, how are you going to make sure that the person you're going to help is going to benefit from it and you're going to get nothing else in return? That seems like a simple question for you, I know, but believe me, it's not.
I was on a river trip with a guy. I actually own the company, and this is, it's so interesting that you brought this up because it slapped me in the face when he said it. We were headed down the Rogue River in Oregon, and we were just talking about life, and he said that I would never help someone unless I knew there was something in it for me.
He said that about you?
No, he said that about himself.
Oh, fuck that.
But at least he was putting it out there, you know, that's how he saw life.
Hey, yeah, you got to start somewhere. Was he saying it in a way of saying, help me? Or was he saying in a way of like, this is the way anybody should be?
I think he was trying to justify how he was. And to this day.
This is the way it should be then.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And I can't speak to it today, but I can tell you that back then, he was the most unfulfilled river guide we had in our corps, in our group of guides. And so,
what made him unfulfilled? Like, what did you see in him?
There was quid pro quo in everything. He wasn't happy because he wasn't 100% unselfishly, periodically giving of himself. Everything that he did had a return engagement attached to it. And so, it's impossible for me to give you a recipe as we sit here today for how you can do something that doesn't have some ulterior motive, except to ask yourself, does this feel like it's right?
So here's the problem, is that that's hardwired into people until they really go through a big personal growth area. Because as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, that was me for my life until about a year and a half ago. And the first thing I was thinking of, the first story that came into my head was when I was in college, I actually had this reputation that my friends made a verb for what I would do, and it's called the bud something. And you basically would bud something by getting your way and manipulate whatever, and you would get the rent reduced or the cable bill for free, or get your friends to agree to something. And, you know, I always, you know, laughed about everything like that, and everything was justified. What, like your river guide, like do something for me, didn't do something for you. And then as I was starting to break away from that a little bit, and one of my friends Kyle would just, I would do something nice and he'd be like, what do you want? Yeah. And I was just like, shit. Now they're starting, as I continue to do it, and as I've been going on this personal growth, which I still get into these self-centered things. It's something that I battle on a weekly basis. It was something that I was battling on a daily basis. So I'm happy it's now weekly instead of daily. And I hope for it to be monthly one day. And I hope for it to be yearly after that. And I'm happy that I've recognized that I was like that instead of just being like, well, yeah, but you need to do that in order to not finish last because nice guys finish last because that's the way I fucking thought.
Right.
But he would say that and now he's saying it less, but it was just killing me. I was like, okay, you did that. Can you keep doing good and you'll change that perception. It'll take some time, but it will start. And it has been. He's been now saying it less. And he would keep on saying it to this day if I were doing it, because he just likes to get under my skin. But if it's not justified, then there's no point on him saying it. Like, no, you were just doing that because you want to see me, you want to hang out,
right,
and stuff like that. It's not like, what do I need to give you? What do I need to pay for in order to reciprocate what you did for me, bud?
So what was the trigger? I mean, why? What caused the pivot?
It was going into an incredibly dark place. So it was when my wife, now ex-wife, who I still am great friends with this day, and we run the business together, Sarah, she left me in January. And when she did, this isn't recording, right? Right, Mitch? but yeah, when she left me, and at the time I was so angry. I had an anger problem too. Mm-hmm. That also was justified. So my anger would be, I would be like, Sarah, like, unleash this anger fire of breath. I would never be violent, but I'd be verbally violent, but never physically. But still, I would unleash it and I'd feel justified. Like, you deserve this because of how you screwed up, right? And this will make you learn. You'll learn from this anger fire never to do it again. And I was just left with a burnt down building and bridge and stuff. We would go out to dinner and I would always be like, what the fuck are you talking about? When she would say this to me. And she would say, people, God, bud, again, they're just like, you'd go to the bathroom and they'd be like, Sarah, are you okay?
Oh.
And she'd be telling me this in the car, and I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? That was fine. And I look back at that being like, oh my God, I know what she was talking about now. Hmm. I justified in my mind everything I was doing over and over again. And so it took her leaving me for me to go into this place where I didn't even want to leave bed for like a few weeks. And then I accidentally found stoicism, philosophy, and then I dove into that. And that really gravitated towards me because I've always pictured myself as like one of my strengths is leadership. I don't think I was doing it in the best way before stoicism, but it seems to be a philosophy that's really good for people in leadership positions and roles, or who want to be, but they're really a management role or not being a good leader. Perhaps that's more of what I was before. Mm-hmm. And so I really gravitated towards it, and it made me start realizing that, I recognize those drives home, and I recognize the anger, and what good will being angry and upset at anything, not just her, but anybody, anything, actually, what will that do? Like, is that going to make anything better? And I still get little slip ups. I was having one actually just this morning. I didn't get out too much, but like, it was just like, where's Mitch with the water? Like, we got to get going and stuff like that. Like, this whole podcast is going to blow up if you came in here 30 seconds later. But at the time I was just like, motherfucker, like in my head, but that counts as me being angry. Even though I didn't say it to him, I'm sure you probably felt it a little bit just in my actions, or maybe you didn't. I don't know, but I was a little more jagged. You can talk up. Seriously. It's all right.
I didn't really notice.
Okay, well, I did.
But I want to let you know that this water did seem interestingly aged when we got it, like 30 seconds aged.
It's a fine year.
So anyway, that's a long-winded answer to your question, but that's what made me start realizing it. And I went from, I'm going to buy Sarah out, how dare she leave me, to, and no, we built this company together. She's my partner, and we're going to continue to. I mean, we're not romantically, I have a girlfriend who I love, and she has a boyfriend, and we are not romantically involved anymore, but we are really good business partners, and we continue to grow it every day. And a normal thing would just be like, you screwed up, you know, stuff like that. No, not at all. Like, yeah. I don't come close to that. The times I do, I immediately apologize, because right. It was a daily thing, maybe even an hourly thing. Mm-hmm. Now it's like I'm happy that the whole fist pound thing, that doesn't even happen at all anymore. But raising my voice, probably a monthly thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm so pissed once I do that. I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah. So you're as you know, you're not alone. And I'm the same way. I've had this question that we ask in our house or in our home with our kids, who benefits from you doing that? And I've always thought that was a clever way of getting kids to think about, and me to think about their actions and whether or not it was a smart thing or a good thing to do. And a couple weeks ago, I was driving down the road, and my daughters were in the back seat, and one of them said something that I didn't agree with, and I took off my hat and I threw it against the console up by the windshield, and scared my daughter. My anger pissed her off.
How did you feel after that? Did you feel it right away?
No, not right. I felt it when my other daughter said, "Hey, Dad, who benefited from you just throwing that hat?"
Ooh,
yeah. So
it turned the tables on you, huh?
100%. And so we're all in this struggle. We're all in this struggle of trying to basically reel in our demons. Mm-hmm. And the key, and actually the book.
But I wasn't, though.
No, you weren't then.
Right?
No.
I didn't. And I'm sure there's other people that were like me back then. They're just like, no, this is fine. This is the way you should act. This is how you get shit done.
Oh, there's people outside of this room that act that way, outside of this building that act this way. But the key in the second book that I recommended or have recommended or given out is Why Buddhism is True. And I'm not a practicing Buddhism. I just love the idea of spirituality and what happens in different religions. And so I read that book and it blew my mind. And what you're describing is essentially consciousness and your ability to deal with thoughts by being aware of the thoughts. That's a critical skill to learn, and sometimes it takes hitting bottom. And I've hit bottom too, and I've had to reinvestigate what it is that I'm doing and what I'm thinking about and why I'm thinking that, and change literally, hopefully, moment to moment, the way that I react to things. But it's not easy. It's so hard. So hard. And part of it, interestingly, it's just human nature, because evolutionarily we're in a period of time where we've only existed like how we are for 1% of the entire human continuum. If you believe in evolution, if you believe in creationism, then that question can't be answered. But if you believe in evolutionism, then we're at 1% of our entire evolution. 99% of human existence has been different than industrial age, kind of hierarchical structure.
Right, yeah.
And so we have in us this DNA, this genetic predisposition to act certain ways in order to preserve ourselves. And sometimes that's judgment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's fear. Sometimes it's connection. So we can't deny that whole human side, and getting angry is part of that. And given the fact, though, that we now have more creature comforts and time and the ability to be conscious, we're able to change who we are individually, and then thankfully, hopefully, by changing how we are as a species.
Yeah, fascinating on that is cortisol.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, we were evolved for it to go off to save our lives from saber-toothed tigers.
Yep.
Right? Fight or flight, make split-second decisions. It's like a bunch of deer that are in the grass, and one of them goes, and then the rest go,
yep.
And it's because there's like, what was that? And that was them like looking for a wolf or a lion or things like that to know, like, is it time to go or can we keep eating? Yep. And cortisol is in us as a protection mechanism. Right. It's a stress to make sure that we are alert and that our adrenaline goes up and we're ready to do what we need to do. And it's designed to not be hitting all the time.
Right.
But now we're in a society where it's on a constant drip.
And what do we do with it? You know, if we don't go out and exercise, if we don't ride a mountain bike, we don't go walking along a river, if we don't figure out ways to disconnect from mm-hmm. that drip, then at some point we're going to explode.
Yeah, and that drip is from the quote you is economic
largely,
fear.
Yep, largely. Yeah, so in my TED talk, I talk about the difference between economic fear and real fear. Mm-hmm. And the influencers of the cortisol production mm-hmm. is largely the industries of fear. And we talked a little bit about that before, pharmaceuticals, media, insurance. There's big money in it, and the goal, I think, is for people to recognize when they're being influenced by the economics of fear versus when their behavior is shifting because they have to, because it's real fear. And just being conscious of that, being conscious of the fact that 50% of the commercials that you watch on TV are designed for you to be afraid mm-hmm. and to go buy something because you're afraid. And then there's the 10% of commercials, like Subaru is a perfect example, where you're buying a car because when you do buy a Subaru, you're going to feel love.
Right.
And so that's the flip side to it. The challenge is to remain conscious of the economics of fear and to replace what you might be doing when it comes to how that's feeding you on a daily basis with your choices of media sources. Mm-hmm. But not just by eliminating other things, but by adding new things. And, you know, if you go out and you coach a soccer team instead of watching television, huge difference in terms of the effect that that can have on how you behave, and getting back to the cortisol, mm-hmm. getting back to engaging in activities that are designed to reduce that cortisol or other hormones that are designed for you to freak out because the lion is coming.
Right. But then you say, okay, drop the Netflix and the TV. But God, that's so addicting. I mean, I'm not a saint. Like I read a lot, mm-hmm. or I think I do, a lot more than I used to. But I still gotta watch me some Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So I'm not saying to eliminate it, yeah. But if you have a choice between watching the news, mm-hmm. the nightly news, the half hour of gloom and doom that comes on at 6 to 6:30. Actually, it's 22 minutes of programming.
It's now 20. You know, it's 24/7 now, right?
The CNN, yeah.
And then my Facebook mistake. And all that stuff. It's not just a half hour anymore.
Oh, wait. Where's
it's that? Not Walter Cronkite anymore.
I got to get out.
I love Tom Brokaw. Me and my dad watched him all the time. I loved it. But it's now they monetize it to be constant.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Look at all the things that we are going to explode as a planet.
Yeah.
Tonight.
Yeah. So I got to get out of my cave a little bit more often. I'm sorry. I'm unaware that news is 24/7. But if you replace, so I got to go back to this whole idea. There's 22 minutes of programming in the nightly news. Mm-hmm. Out of that, 20 minutes is dedicated to you're going to die, that person sucks, and the world is going to explode.
They do have a one good feel good thing at the
at
end.
At the very end.
It's about 90 seconds of feel good.
And you know why they do that?
It's because they feel bad about what they're doing.
Maybe. No, it's all, they've all studied it. They've studied it. Because if they have rocked your world throughout that 20 minutes mm-hmm. and got you to glom on to advertising in order to make yourself more secure, more healthy, whatever, by buying something, then when that feeling is attached to you, I got to go buy this, I got to go participate in this in order to get this fear out of my system, and then you're flooded with the idea of love, and mm-hmm. it cements that fear.
God, you know what? I just had a realization too on that whole thing. The ads. They're fucking Zoloft.
Yeah.
Fear, fear, fear. Here's just pharmaceutical companies peddling their stuff. Here, you're afraid about terrorism. Here's some Prozac and Zoloft. It's going to be great. And back to this, we got to be afraid of next. More Zoloft.
Right.
That fucking cloud thing that hops around.
Oh.
That commercial. It's all a recipe.
It's a recipe for being dependent on something other than yourself to calm yourself down, other than your community, to feel connection. It's a money-driven recipe for mm-hmm. societies that will begin to wither as the result of the dependence on something other than ourselves.
Which brings me to a book that I would recommend for people, and I'll gift it to you after this because we talked about it briefly, but Factfulness from Hans Rosling. It's highly recommended from Bill Gates and other people. Basically, it's like 10 facts to show you that we're not in such bad of a shape, that the media makes you think.
And just to prove to you that Bud walks the walk, when I walked in today and looked at the bookshelf, it's the top book on the shelf.
It is a top book. But it's fascinating just being like the news, the 24-hour news now is all saying North Korea, all this horrible stuff, you know, constantly. And he just proves out statistically that, he keeps on saying it like, I'm not saying we're perfect. We have a lot of things to fix, but we need to take a step to just give each other a pat on the back. The fact that infant mortality rates have dropped like 95% in the last 100 years is insane. Like you were talking about the evolution for how long people have been. This is just 1%. Well, in that 1% time, right. Holy crap, the advancements we've made.
Right.
The fact that we know that the world is, some people know the world is a globe, some think it's flat. But the fact that we can go around it as fast as we can, the leaded gasoline countries that don't exist anymore, there's like three left, it was like pretty much all of them, women literacy rates, it goes on and on and on. And you walk away after putting that book down and go, you know, I shouldn't be so afraid. I shouldn't be going around saying it's going bad. Because one of the main things that he was pointing out is as he continued to survey all of these scholars and professors at all these universities they came and gave talks to, he would ask questions like, is the world getting better or worse?
Right.
And they would put in the little keypad thing and be in real time, and it's pretty much 80% of all these highly educated people saying, getting worse. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, that's interesting. Let's break that down and just destroy that whole notion. It's right. Like, actually, it's been getting incredibly better.
Right.
Yes, we need to do other things better, but stop drinking the Kool-Aid.
Stop drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
We're doing good.
Steven Pinker in The Better Angels of Our Nature says the same kind of thing. And what we have to do is recognize that, and we talked about this last week, is that we're in a human race. Mm-hmm. And the race is whether or not we kill ourselves or whether or not we create a society that flourishes. And so much good is happening now. And so much good is happening right out in your office and right up the street and right in the next town. And that's kind of what Be the Good is about, is it stop and notice the good that's around you and build off of that. Because in order to win the human race, we have to recognize that we are good, we can do good, and it starts in your backyard, it starts just up your street. And take advantage of all the good things that are happening right now to continue to build the good and to win the human race.
I truly believe that deep down we are all very good, and a lot of people act on that. And one big fact on that is we could have blown each other up for 80 years.
Right.
We could have blown the crap out of the entire world, but we haven't done it.
Right. So it's interesting you bring that up. You talked about North Korea, and the first chapter in the book is about when my family and I, my three kids.
Fascinating chapter, by the way. That's insane. Sorry, I'm cutting. Yeah,
no problem.
Go on.
No problem. So we're in Hawaii last January. My daughter's a gymnast, and we had an opportunity with our local gym to go over and compete in this gymnastics meet, or she did. So we decided to go to Hawaii. And we're in Hawaii at the gymnastics meet, and my son, we're driving to a store, and my son's has this thing pop up on his phone. He's in the back seat of the car. And he says, Dad, did you get the message? You get the message? And I said, no, what message? And he said, there's a bomb coming our way. And then it pops up on my phone. And it says, this is not a drill. Seek shelter. Inbound missile.
What happened right in your head right then? Right after you read it, what's the first thing?
So my daughter and my wife were back at the meet. We were driving. I immediately U-turned and said, I have to get back to my family. I need to get all my family together. And we need to get as far away from Honolulu as we can, because...
And you also saying you were 10 miles from Pearl Harbor.
10 miles from Pearl Harbor, 10 miles from Honolulu, because North Korea has been threatening to push the button. And they pushed the button. Mm-hmm. And so we need to get as far away as we can, as quickly as we can, from a population center that they're most likely to strike. Interestingly, the people of Hawaii at that point had been practicing nuclear drills, because they knew it took 20 minutes from the time that the button got pushed in North Korea until it hit their island. And so there was no time. We U-turned, went back to the gym, and as I'm walking into the gym, I'm on my phone trying to find my wife. People are stunned in silence. Hawaiians that know this shit is real, mm-hmm, are stunned. And my wife said, we're back in the very back corner in the small locker room, because that's where we were told to go. So I'm walking back to that locker room, and the meet organizer gets on the microphone. He says, folks, we have 15 minutes to impact. All we can do is pray.
So at that moment, you have your family, right? You have them all with you. What do you say right after that?
there's one daughter starts to cry.
As she probably should.
Am I going to die? Am I going to die? I couldn't.
How many people are in the room?
There's 50 people plus or minus in this little locker room.
So you gotta be hearing people crying. Oh. You gotta be hearing hysterical shit.
So what's interesting is it was quiet and deep, sad emotion at that point. And the parents are looking at each other going, what the fuck do we do here? Because, you know, if there's a hurricane, you kind of have a sense of what to do. If there's an earthquake, you have a sense of what to do. When there's a nuclear bomb headed your way, you kind of just don't know what to do. You haven't practiced for that.
Well, there's not really much you can practice for unless you have a bunker.
Whether it hits you or not, there's a good chance you're going to die either from the impact or from the fallout.
Right.
So one daughter's saying, am I going to die? She's crying. Another daughter is holding a friend of hers. Parents are weeping. Parents are looking at their phone, just trying to figure out what's going on. My son leans against the wall. At that point, he was 14. He leans against the wall, and he's starting to text people. And I didn't know what he was texting. I was trying to figure out what I should be doing. But I could see he was texting people. So for about 10 minutes, we all believed we were going to die in that room. And the chapter in the book talks about how I got pissed off that morning because we were going to be late to the gymnastics meet.
Right, 10 minutes late, right?
Yeah, I realized here, I'm in this
while you're driving
place,
along a beautiful highway, right?
Along the Hawaiian coast. And I'm pissed, and everybody in the car feels that I'm pissed. And that's how I spent the last morning with my family. Are you fucking kidding me? I spent the last morning of my life with my family pissed. So 10 minutes of that, of just soul searching and comfort, ended when somebody got an alert on their phone that the alert was a mistake. It came from a state senator. It was a mistake. And then more and more of those pieces of news came up. And so we were within, 10 minutes of being annihilated based on the time frame. And when you're in a super intense position like that, you try to keep your wits about you and you try to focus on what to do to save your family.
Right.
So there's a lid on the emotion in a room like that. The parents have a lid on their emotion, trying to comfort their kids and trying to figure out what to do. But when that lid got blown off with the announcement that there was no bomb, that's when it was just a huge, huge outpouring of emotion. People crumbled to the floor. People started crying and wailing. And
Jesus.
It was intense because we all knew we were going to die. And so we left the little locker room and went out to start the gymnastics meet, which is a fascinating paradox, where you've got these little 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old girls that thought they were going to die 10 minutes before, and now they're warming up for a gymnastics meet. And I asked my son, what were you texting? And he said, I may not get through this. He said, I was texting my friends to tell them goodbye and that I was sorry if I ever hurt their feelings. So chapter one is the title of that, and learning one good thing to do is to be less certain.
I'm not surprised, as I read that and as you're telling me now that I haven't met your son, but just the man you are that he would do something like that.
It was tough, and I'm not a perfect father. I'm not close to a perfect father, and my son is not a perfect son. He's a teenager.
Well, sure, he was, but what he was doing in those moments was...
It's from the gut, from the heart, entirely. Mm-hmm. You strip it all down, you want to get back now to talking about doing right and being right. In moments like that, you recognize what is more right than anything, and that is that time is precious and love is all. And if you can remind yourself of that once or twice a day, you'll change the way that you behave and you'll make your community better.
Are you angry at the guy who accidentally did that?
No. I'll tell you who I was angry at that point. I was angry with Donald Trump and I was angry with Kim Jong-il, or however you say his name.
Why?
That those two guys would let their egos threaten my family. That's what pissed me off.
Well, sure, but the Korean dictators have been, that's been something that's been going on for years.
You don't
way before Donald Trump and everything like that. It's always been at least that's what the propaganda's taught us, to hate that country. They're not even called North Korea. They call ourselves the Democratic Republic of Korea, by the way.
Right. And so there's no question that that's been going on for a long time. And there's no question that some percentage of your psyche knows that annihilation is always possible. But when you're faced with it, when you're faced with it, when you know that bomb is coming your way, then it becomes crystal clear about the importance of putting aside egoic posturing, no matter who's doing it, putting aside ego-driven posturing in the name of humanity.
It does seem that good came from that, though.
Next time I'm in Hawaii, I guarantee you I'm not going to be pissed if we're 10 minutes late to take it down to
I bet you kind of think about that on a daily basis.
I do. No, I do. And it's helped me become a better person. That cold, hard slap in the face has helped me become a better person. I got a long way to go till I'm a great person. I gotta jump on it. I gotta push because of that event.
Right? I have never gone through anything like that. And I was just sitting here kind of just silent, being like, you were telling the story so well. I felt like I was in the room. It's just like, it's insane. And I guess what I was saying a bit earlier, like only things are only bad if you say they're bad. They're good if you say they aren't. Like everybody, like, that's horrible that you had to go through that. And I'm kind of looking at it as like, what luck you have to actually know how close you could come to death that easily.
That's huge. And then interestingly, a friend of mine said only you would be going, it would have gone through that, because I've had a life full of crazy rich adventures, nothing like that. But it wasn't in the book. I'd written 20 chapters.
Right. Okay.
And then that happened. And it's like, I have an opportunity to tell this story in order to help somebody make a shift in their life for their own good. And so I'm going to put it in the book, and that's a gift to me. And I'm saying this hopefully without any kind of ego to it. I hope it's a gift to somebody else.
Well, it's already a gift to me. I mean, I walked away reading that chapter and then talking to you, just like, you know, that's a fascinating way to think. Like it's one of those things. Marcus Aurelius says, don't live your life as if you were going to live for 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think like that. I'll be good tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I'll be good next year. I'll do better then. Just thinking you're going to be around for so long.
And you know how you can shift that today or tomorrow, depending on when you go to the grocery store next, and getting back to your ulterior motive for giving. When you first walk into the grocery store, there's a good chance that the floral area, the flowers area, is going to be right near where you're walking in. It's either going to be on that side of the store or the other. So it's, sure, it's right near the entrance.
50%.
Pick up a bouquet of flowers, $1.99 bouquet of flowers, and put it in your shopping cart or in your basket. And when you get to the checkout stand, either give it to the checker or give it to the person behind you. It's that simple. It's that simple to change somebody's day one step at a time.
That's so selfless. I love that. Well, okay. Last question before I go to Safeway and buy some flowers for the checkout person. Yeah. If you were to have a billboard for the world to see, what would it say?
I think it would say, be less certain.
Be less certain.
Yeah. And the reason that
That's chapter one. That goes back to the why thing.
And the reason that I say that is because if I do say so myself, it's thought-provoking. Mm-hmm. And so if you're driving down the road and you see a billboard and all it says is be less certain, hopefully you would wonder what that is about and why that matters to you. And it can mean I need to stop taking such strident political positions. I need to make sure that my boss knows that this is a good place to work because I'm certain he feels otherwise. It means looking at the guy in the lane next to you who may be driving a little goofy and being less certain about whether or not he's an asshole because he's a bad driver. Maybe he's having a bad day. Maybe he's got some kind of medical condition. Maybe he's just got his mind somewhere else because he's hurting. Mm-hmm. And so be less certain gives you an opportunity to think about how you're behaving in the world that could be creating something less than what you're capable of creating.
You think your next book is going to be that?
Actually, I'm already working on my next book. It's called Life Jacket, and it's stories of travels from around the world. And each interaction that I had with different people in the world have taught me life lessons. Like compassion, that's a chapter in the book. Mm-hmm. Laughter is a chapter in the book. I was once stuck in a taxi in a town in Siberia for 4 hours with three friends trying to find an apartment where this party was going on. And what I recognized in that is that we could have either just been super pissed about the fact that we couldn't find this place and we were driving around and around and around in a city of a million people trying to find this place, or we could laugh about it. So that's one of the chapters in the next book. So it's characters of life that give me life lessons, and that's what I hope to impart.
Well, like Be the Good, I look forward to reading Life Jacket.
Right.
Thanks, Ken, bud. Thanks for coming on the show, man.
It's been great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.